I'm sure that with the dedicated effort that you all will ultimately put out, that the second step will come to Nebraska. Up to this point, I have not met anybody that has applied it. Especially about four guys from Bellevue that are sitting in the back. That made me an unofficial speaker a few years ago out here. I'd like to congratulate John and Stu and Ski. Looking over this audience, you've cured half of them. They've gone away to drink no more. And if that happens, you'll have to take blame for it. Make a list of those names, Scott, of those who aren't here. My name is John Sullivan, and I am an alcoholic. I'm not about to tell you all my name, Jack. If you all start that high, Jack, they'll have every airport policeman in the country in there. You walk across an airport sometime, a guy's about 50 yards away, and he hollers, "Hi, Jack!" God, everybody in that airport will turn around and stop and look. I have a sobriety date of 10:30 in the morning, and I know that because it's a psychiatric hospital said so. They have records of the 21st day of August of 1962. And I'm very, very glad to be back in Omaha. Peg Martin told me tonight I've been here so damn much I ought to get a home group here. But, that would be a bad idea. It's really neat to be around all you guys. You're nuts, but it's neat. And I certainly enjoy being here. There's a couple places that I wished I could have been this weekend. Like all things in AA, there, you know, you have things going on. And Friday night up home, young fellow, we have an AA group on the racetrack up home. I'm proud to say that I was one of the people who helped start it, and the people who work on the backside of racetracks have a lot of problems with alcohol and drugs, as you can imagine. And so we started an AA group on the back stretch of Churchill Downs, and one of our first persons that we ever were able to came and you know, we talked to was sober a year Friday night. And he got a token Friday night for a year's sobriety. And I would have liked to have been there and shared it with him. And then last night in Kansas City, our friend Larry Traeger celebrated his 39th year in AA. So that's a long time. And last year, Gay and I went up, and I won't see what time I started here. I think I've got it figured out how long it takes to get to three tapes. And you ain't turning this damn mic off. I've assigned three people in the audience. One is for one tape. The second one raised his hand was through two tapes. Anyway. You don't have a gavel up here. What a guy in Louisville came one time up here to talk, and he talked, and he talked, and he talked, and talked. And the guy that invited him got so damn disgusted with him, he just wouldn't shut up. So he had a gavel laying there on the podium, and he picked the gavel up and threw it at him. And he missed him. And hit some lady in the audience, knocked her cold in the head. He ran at her with a glass of water and threw it in her face and apologized. He came to her, and he said, "I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you?" She said, "Yes, hit me again. I can still hear that bastard." I don't know whether Jerry's got a gavel over there or not. But anyway, what I was going to tell you about Larry, I don't want to tell you all this, but you know, it doesn't bother me. I came here this morning, I knew I was going to talk, okay? You came in here, you knew you was going to listen. If you get through before I do, you go on home. It won't bother me. It won't bother me at all. But last year again, I went up to Larry's birthday, 38 years in AA. And if you're going to join AA group, go to Kansas City. They have birthday parties up there. Like a kid has a birthday party. Never been anything like it in my life. They bring presents. You know, Larry's sitting up there at that speaker's table. Everybody comes to the door, got a damn box. All kinds of birthday presents. When they say birthday parties, that's what they mean. Birthday parties. And I'm going up there and join the group. Get all them gifts. I'm afraid to do that out here, I'd get a couple of them packages and be ticking. See a couple of people back there I'd be suspect of. But that's a long time to be an AA. And it's, you know, it's nice to know those people. We've lost so many of them the past couple of years. And some of the good ones, the good old guys, you know. John Inden, epitome of a dear friend. Down in Texas, where John's from, a guy named John Carlton. You know, and a dear friend up in Roanoke, Virginia, named Bill Hollingsworth. There's Wino Gill. And guys that you just learn to love in this program because they stayed here and fought for all the things they believed to be true and kept it together so we could have what we got today. Yeah, they were tough, of course, mean old fools, but, you know, they believed in what was in that book. And they fought for what was in that book. That's why you and I got what we got today. And I, sometime in our society, we need to remember that. There ain't a damn thing important in here except what's in that book. I don't give a damn who you are. You ain't got no right talking about anything up here except what's in that book. You can't be everything to everybody. And all you need to be is an alcoholic and you do real well. It's not popular. You know. You got to be an anda. Alcoholic anda. This ain't cool anymore. Just be plain. I'm an alcoholic and I'm an abused adult spouse of an Al-Anon. I'm an adult child of normal parents. You know why grizzly bears won't eat Al-Anons? Professional courtesy. I'll probably be here for a couple more days. I love them old guys, you know. Miss them. And I don't think we should ever forget them. Wino Joe had his own 20 questions he'd ask people. You ever had the roof of your mouth sunburned? He was a hell of a lot smarter than John Hopkins. Can you puke out of a window while driving a car without it blowing back in on you? Important thing. Back when they got sober, there were stigmas. Whatever the hell that is. Stigmas attached to alcoholism. John Carlton told me that he had two brothers. One was a Republican, the other was a homosexual, and they thought more of them than they did him. It was a stigma to alcoholism. I guess that's gone. It's Mother's Day and Sunday morning. Used to be on Sunday morning, all the conferences got a spiritual speaker. I don't know what happened this one. I've only known two kinds of people in AA. There are soul savers and ass kickers. And I told one of them new kids I was sponsoring that I was coming out here, and he said, "When are you talking?" I said, "Sunday morning." He said, "Oh, sure." I told him I didn't deserve to talk at her on Sunday morning because I was mad at God and it was his fault. I've been mad at God for 3 months now. Run him out of the house. I want him around there. Want him to stay out. I'll tell you what happened. I think you deserve an explanation. I'm retired, and this kid was in my house, one of them newcomers. And my wife said that she was going to bury me standing up. She thought the change of position would do me good. And that kid looked at her and says, "Why don't you bury him face down so you can see where he's going?" I said, "I don't have to listen to that crap off of you, 17-year-old newcomer. What the hell you doing in my house? The hell did you get in here? Who sent you here?" He said, "According to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, God sent me to you." I ain't spoke to God since. Don't know that I ever will again. And when I came in AA in 1962, I was 33 years old. And I was the youngest member of Alcoholics Anonymous in City Low. And they looked at me rather suspiciously at that age. They thought you had more drinking to do. You had to get real old in order to be here. And another old friend we lost recently up in St. Louis, Paul Keebler, I think Paul would have been sober 48 years if he'd lived and just died a couple years ago. Paul said when he came in AA, which would now have been 48 years ago, he said they had a measuring stick. If you had 9 teeth, a wristwatch, and you could count up to 10, they wouldn't let you in. You had to lose something else. And now look at them at the age they come in. And we allow it. 15, 16, 17 years old. Strange names. Some of them are addicted to wood. Some of them have some kind of difficulty with the Dow Chemical Company. I ran into one the other day that was strange. He said he was poly-addicted. I thought, my God, he likes to have sex with parrots. I ain't so sure I was wrong. Anyway, but at 33, they thought, you know, that was kind of young to be here. But I'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think it would have done any good if I'd have heard of it. I'm one of those people that learn from my own experiences. I never was very good at learning from other people. We come in here to these meetings and say we're here to share experience, strength, and hope to those that want to listen, and I don't think I would have been those that wanted to listen. I just was never very good at learning from others. I had to learn from me, and that can be destructive as hell. There's only two ways, literally, to have an experience, your own or somebody else that's already had it that you're willing to listen to. And I wasn't willing to listen to other people. I had a psychiatrist about a year ago tell me, I love stories. And we were talking along the lines of people that were willing to learn from others. And he said, "Let me tell you a story about a woman that had a poly parrot, very polite parrot. People would come to visit, and the parrot would welcome them. Said, 'Thank you for visiting. We're so glad you're here. It's nice of you to come.' And a lady said, 'This is interesting. How in the world did you ever train that parrot to be that polite?' She said, 'Well, I didn't train him. So when I got a hold of that parrot, he was filthy mouth thing, cussed like a Key West sailor,' said he was awful. She said, I got so disgusted with him, I grabbed him one day by his feet and I threw him in a freezer. And she said, in about 15 minutes, I felt sorry for him and went back and let him out. And said, have you learned your lesson? Will you quit cursing? And the parrot said, yes, ma'am, I'll never cuss again. But he said, tell me, what the hell did that turkey do? So the parrot learned from the turkey. And I'm sure that sitting in this audience, there are some parrots and there are some turkeys. Yeah, there's some of you. They'll have to skin you, wrap you, and freeze your ass before you'll ever learn anything. And I'm sure that I would have been a turkey. And you know, when I think back and look at, and you think of a Sunday morning, and around 8 years ago, all the Sunday morning speakers were the girls from New York. It seemed like they always talked on Sunday morning. And the preachers and the priests, and it was a spiritual meeting. And I think somebody finally wised up that if you come here on Friday night, you've come to a spiritual meeting. And if you come Saturday morning and Saturday night, you come to spiritual meeting because you've heard all week from these speakers who carried a spiritual message that they have finally recognized there's somebody else on this earth besides them. And they have made peace with the God that they understand and taken their place with their fellow man. And a frank and stark realization there's somebody else on this planet besides you. And that we can work in harmony with God and other people, and to some degree have dedicated our lives to that out of pure selfishness. And the big book tells us that. Everything I know, the big book told me. The big book told me to be very selfish. And by that they meant that if I would make my peace with a God that I could understand and with my fellow man, and become willing to share and to help, that the return that I would receive would be enormous. That irregardless of what you got out of that, the things that I got out of it would be greater than any of us could have ever expected. And I never could understand that when I was young. And my mother, and today is Mother's Day, and I'm sure that's why a lot of people aren't here. And personally, I don't think they ought to be here. And I say that because if you've been to AA very long, you should have a total, full, and useful life. This program was given to us so that we could enjoy living. And that means being good to your wife, and good to your kids, and good to your mother, and be where you're supposed to be at that particular time, doing what you're supposed to do, because we were never too good at that. And I'm sure that a lot of people that aren't in these seats are with their mothers, and that's where they belong. And I don't recall or talk a whole lot about my mother in Alcoholics Anonymous because my mother died when I was about 18 or 19 years old. And my mother had been a very sickly woman all of her life with a blood disease. My mother would have blood blotches all over her body, like clots that had burst. And it was caused by some sort of a spleen infection of some sort. And as I understand it today, and well, the doctor who treated her is a good friend of mine, and he's in AA today. And he tells me that what killed my mother, that would have been in the 50s. Let's see, I was born in 1929. She died when I was 18, what, 47? 1946, 47. And what killed my mother is cured today with antibiotics. But she wouldn't even need to be hospitalized. They had medicine that would have cured her of the ailment that killed her. So she was not a big part of my life, but she took me as a child to church to learn about religion and God. And she tried to give me the proper attitudes. And she tried to give us a good example and hope that when we got out into the world, we would choose wisely, and perhaps that's all we have to give to us. And everything that they took me to and taught me about, I didn't have any connection with. I never had any feeling for. And as far back as I can remember, when the talked about God, they talked about thou shalt not, and you'd better not, and everything he set in judgment of for people like us to condemn and convict and to burn into the pits of hell. And I never had any feeling for that. I never remember having any feeling for that. And I know today that knowledge is useful. But to people like you and I, feelings are absolutely necessary. We have to feel about what we believe, or it doesn't do a lot of good. That I was taught when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that words without feelings were rather useless. And I can recall all of the words as a child about God and religion, but I don't recall any feelings about it. And I never had any connection with it, to my knowledge. I have a brother and two sisters who did, obviously, because they didn't follow the same path that I did. And for the first 13 years on this earth, I'd done real well. I graduated as a salutarian of a Catholic grade school up home. Seemed like studies came easy. I made good grades in school. And when I got to be about 14 years old, I was working on the racetrack up there at Churchill then. And, well, in fact, I was a little younger than that. I was over doing a little stable work with one of the most famous farms up that way, Calumet. Any of you who are racehorse people, remember in 1941 there was a famous horse that named Whirlaway that won the Kentucky Derby, and I was around Calumet Farm Stables in Whirlaway, 12 years old. And the reason for that was the trainer and the people that worked there were very dear friends of the pastor of Holy Name Church, and I met them through that. And got over there around that racetrack and with an older crowd of people. And when I went to high school for the first 2 years, I had a very bad attitude about things. And I'm not talking about drinking. And my attitude in my second year of high school called the Bavarian brothers of that Catholic high school to call me and tell me they didn't want me in there anymore. I'm not a school worker. We don't like the attitude. And I had a bad attitude, and I carried that into AA with me. And again, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells you that it's an impossibility to stay sober. An impossibility to stay sober until you change your attitude. Unless you bring a good one in here. Some people do. I wasn't one of them. When I got to be about 15 years old, I got out to 4th and Central, and that corner out there was a neat place. It borders Churchill Downs Racetrack, and I'm sure if you've never been there, most everybody has seen the Kentucky Derby on television. In fact, if you were watching, you saw it 2 weeks ago. And 4th and Central borders Churchill Downs Racetrack. And that was my corner. That's where I lived and died about four times. And I got out to that corner, and I found an interesting place because I was able to take over a assistant night manager of a filling station that's on the corner of 3rd and Central at the age of 15 with another guy that was about 22. And World War II was just ending, and things were rationed, and you couldn't buy gasoline without coupons. And people would come in there at the end of the month and hand you coupons, and they didn't use them all that month, some of the older people, and you could send them coupons into the federal government and you would still have the gasoline in the tanks. So the guys that ran the saloons and the liquor stores around there, they didn't have any gasoline for their Cadillacs, but they had beer and whiskey, and it was rationed. And they'd bring the beer and whiskey in down there to get the gasoline. We'd put it in the storeroom, drink it, or sell it. Guy ran a drugstore across the street over there. He had cigarettes. You couldn't buy cigarettes, but he had cigarettes, but didn't have any gasoline. So he'd bring the cigarettes over, and we'd give him gasoline. He'd give us cigarettes, and we'd smoke them or sell them. And there was a few girls around there that didn't have any gasoline. And you'll have to draw your own conclusions. And I was on my way. And I began to run with that crowd of people, much to the annoyance of my father. My father did not appreciate what I was doing, where I was going, how long I was staying, who I was with, and I had absolutely no sense of responsibility for somebody 16, 17 years old. I immediately entered into that phase that AA talks about of self-will run right. I did what I wanted to do and had absolutely no regard for anybody else. I look back on that now and see that I certainly had an unmanageable life because I literally demanded that every desire that I had be satisfied. And to hell with you and what you thought. Absolutely no responsibility whatsoever. And my father and I went to war about that constantly. We were constantly at war with who I was with and what I was doing. My grades were going to hell. I was barely getting through school. I finished the high school years in a vocational school there and barely got out of the thing. And just simply because I didn't apply myself. And it was very upsetting to my father. And I just completely ignored him and everything that he had to say. It was in constant argument with him. I never had a decent word for my father. You know, and my mother would kind of stay back out of it because I guess she just really didn't feel like getting into it until she finally died. And he was a dumbass old man. You know, most parents are. When you're that age, that's when you're at your brilliant. I saw a bumper sticker the other day, reminded me of myself. It said, hire a teenager while they still know everything. And I thought, man, that's me. That was me. My father didn't know nothing. All them dumb things he wanted you to do. Go to school, learn and study, and behave yourself, get involved with the church, and run with decent people, and stay away from boozers and hookers and gamblers. Yeah. Stay away from all them evil things that are so much fun. Yeah. I thought he's nuts. Any chance I got, I told him. So the relationship I had with my father was very good. And the only thing that ever changed that relationship or the opinion I had of my father was the squad car. I believe the breeding ground of humility is the back seat of a squad car. You can set some tough drunks down in squad cars and God, they get humble. But it really changes the opinion you have of people. Did you ever go in a bar and listen to some guy talk about that old bitch he lives with? Lock him up. He'll make a phone call and she'll answer. He'll say, honey. Damn squad car. Change her. My father would not support my habit. My father would not contribute to my delinquency. He would have nothing to do with that type of lifestyle that I had. He let me know damn quick. I'm sure my father would have helped me in any way that he could have if he'd have known anything about alcoholism or known anything about AA, but he didn't and neither did I. And the only time I ever changed my opinion about my father was the first time that I was arrested when I was about 20 years old, and now I was into the drinking bath. And drinking was causing problems. Drunken disorderly, public intoxication. And I was arrested for the first time. And I called my father. That dumbass old man. And he answered the phone. And I said, Daddy. He said, what? What do you want? I said, I'm in jail. He said, why did you call me? I said, I thought you might come down here and get me out. Oh, he said, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you. God, I was worried about it. He said, as smart as you are, he said, I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out. And he hung up and he told me, he said, if you ever get in there again, he said, I've never been to jail, but I understand they give you one telephone call. If you ever get in there again, don't waste it. And I never wasted it. Because it would have been senseless to call it. And I'm grateful to be able to stand here today and tell you that my father lived for 8 years of my sobriety. And when my father died in 1970, my father and I were the best of friends. My father thought more of me, I think, than he did anybody in the family. I guess probably because I was sort of a prodigal son. But my father had learned that we could love and respect each other. And not only were we father and son, we were the best of friends. And I'm very, very grateful that I had that opportunity. And I'm here today to tell you that if your mother and father are living, it's very important to do that. Yeah. I know we live a day at a time, And I know you hear a lot about the steps in AA. And I know in due process of time it takes to take them. Because it took me time to take them. Yeah. But there's a lot of that can be done almost immediately. A lot of it. And to put your arm around somebody and tell them you love them and tell them you're sorry and tell them you're going to try to be better because you found a way that you never knew before. They might not be here tomorrow. And I have a lot of friends in this program who would stand here today and tell you, I wish I'd have done that. I was going to do it tomorrow. And they weren't here tomorrow. So if you have them, and you've been sober this weekend, or today, do it. Do it. I'm eternally grateful I had that opportunity with my father. My mother never took the brunt of my drunkenness. So I began to deteriorate. I'm a typical alcoholic. I just progressed. And everybody tried to scare me into not getting worse. You know, and I thought it was interesting, was a little wrapped up in when Steve was talking the other day about that. Because no matter how long you've been sober, when you sit out there in an audience and you listen to speakers, you learn something, you get something, you recall something. And the fear of the physician, the policeman, the judge, the boss, the parent, the wife, of what's going to happen if you don't quit. And if you convince them that you're right, you just instill more fear that needs to be drank away. And that was all that I ever heard. You don't scare alcoholics into quit drinking. You'll find that alcoholics have a lot of healthy fear that's very valuable to you and a tremendous asset to you when you get to AA. It is real neat to be fearful of things that can destroy you. It's real neat to be fearful of things that can hurt you. Whether you realize it or not, you have a healthy fear of fire. You stick your hand over a stove for obvious reasons. If a wildcat comes in that back door, I'm leaving. You can stay. So those kinds of things are good for it, and assets too. When you can get honest in AA, when you can realize honestly what's good for you and what isn't. You know, and so you have a healthy fear of that because it'll hurt you. But that's not the kind of fear they were trying to interject into me. They interjected the fear into me that convinced me that if they were right, I had better take another drink. Because the only thing it makes it go away. And you take the other drink because you know it'll be different. You know it'll be better. It's a fascinating and unbelievable thing to me to have the slightest idea that Alcoholics Anonymous could sum up my entire life in two paragraphs. And many of you that know me, I'm not a reader of the big book, Napoleon. But I want to share this with you because I think I find it interesting the more I think about it. That my entire life could be summarized in two paragraphs. And it's the first two paragraphs of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous entitled Vision for You. And where do you fit into this? For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. But not so with us in those last days of drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt, and one more failure. And the less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society and from life itself. And we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. And the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down upon us. The chilling vapor that is loneliness. God, how we've known loneliness. What better way to more adequately describe it in a chilling vapor. It thickened, it ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out solid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion, and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this will understand. My life story. Two paragraphs. My life story. I drank and knew that in every time it would be different. I went to work for a railroad and eventually lost the job, lost all things that were good and decent, and finally wound up on Skid Row. And everybody tried to stop me. If you don't quit. And man, I've had experts after me. And I've seen experts try to interject fear into alcoholics. We had a woman up here at Long Valley. She tried to win, we'll get that guy to quit drinking. Went down to a costume shop one day and got a devil suit. Put that suit on and hid behind a hedge one night waiting for him to come home drunk. That old drunk come home, she leaped out behind that hedge at him. And she said, I've come to get you. And he backed up and said, who are you? She said, I am the devil. And that old drunk stuck his hand out. He said, put her there. He said, I've been wanting to meet you ever since I married your sister. You don't scare alcoholics. And I drank my way to Skid Row, and it's no big deal, no big place. It's just a place. Skid Row is wherever you are, they say. Skid Row is a state of mind. And sometimes we envision it as a street. And sometimes we envision it as an alley or a concrete jungle somewhere. And it's there. And that's where I went to. I went to the concrete jungle. And I actually, when my father ran me off and the railroad ran me off and things got the way they did, and for the last couple of years of my drinking, I went to live on that concrete jungle they call Skid Row. And I have no regrets. I'm the luckiest alcoholic that ever lived. Because, you see, I never married. I never had any children. And I left the home and went to live in a gutter. And I know that I'm more fortunate than you. And if I had a choice and a life to live over, and it had to be some way, I would hope it would be that way. Because it's a lot easier to go live in a gutter than it is to go get a gutter and take it home with you. And I've seen people in this program that would go out and drag a stinking, filthy gutter into the middle of the living room of some of the finest homes in the country. And I've seen them drag that filthy gutter down through the middle of their living rooms, and in their sick alcoholic minds reach out for the people that love them the most and drug them down through that stinking, filthy mess with them. I've seen them breed everything into their families that bred into an alcoholic. I've seen that feeling of loneliness and despair and insecurity and bewilderment and terror into the eyes of children and into the eyes of wives and husbands who had nothing to do with the drinking. And I've seen that look and belief in the mind of alcoholics who honestly to God believe that those people were responsible in some way for what they've become. And that never happened to me. I left home and went to live in a gutter. I never had a home to take a gutter to. And I'm eternally grateful for that. Eternally grateful. Skid Row is an interesting place sometimes. You meet some nice people on it. Policemen especially. Never cease to be amazed at their intelligence. You know, up home they send them to those academies and educate them. Give them a big automobile and a 5-cell flashlight. Pistol and a stick. You know, people are there getting raped, robbed, and they drive down alleys, hunt winos. There was a hardware store there where we lived, still there, Scobie Hardware. They used to throw out these boxes, cardboard boxes, that things come in, and you could get them and sleep in them. It was before the days of the Dempsey dumpster. They didn't crush them back then. It would be against the law to do it today. People need them. great insulators from weather. Helps alcoholics with their egos. You can be a snob wino if you get there early and get one of them big freezer boxes. You can lay down in those things. You can look some guy trying to lay down in one of them TV console boxes, and you know you're better than he is. You think they ought to get him out of there. He's running the neighborhood. If you sit up in those things in the daytime, lay down in them at night. Keep the weather off of you. Cops ride down alleys and shine lights in them after they've been educated at the academy. Ask you very intelligent questions. What are you doing? You stick your head out and say nothing, and they arrest you. Wouldn't it have been neat to have known something about alcoholism when them cops threw that light in that box? What are you doing? You could have stuck your head out and said, "Officer, I'm progressing." Probably would have slowed him down a little bit anyway. Had a guy in the finance company hunting me back there in that alley. They couldn't find me for months. God, it upsets them. Bartender squealed on me. I'd borrowed $500 on a signature only from a live of a guy that was in charge of a big office at the railroad. When they called him to question about my character, God, he'd have thought I was going to run for an office. So they gave me $500 on my signature only. I hadn't paid them a quarter. Not a dime. A couple of years. I think I owed them $28,000 or something. Anyway, a bartender squealed on me, and they told this guy where I was. He was out collecting. He came back in that cardboard jungle one day, and he saw me sitting in this box. You could tell he didn't belong there. He had on shirt and tie. He finally got up enough nerve, and he came over, and he knocked on my box. I opened the flap to let him in. He said, "Are you Jack Sullivan?" I said, "Yes." And he said something that's stupid. I don't know to this day what he meant. Told me who he was, and he said, "You realize you haven't made any payments on this loan in a couple of years?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "If you don't start making some payments on this thing, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble." I don't know what the hell he meant. You couldn't tar and feather. And it was neat how that I got out of that thing later on down the line, very honestly. A lawyer at the railroad, actually an alcoholic lawyer with a keen mind. Keen alcoholic mind, isn't it neat? I don't know anybody ever say that about alcoholics. But anyway, we looked at bankruptcy and his company was willing to settle for what they'd give me if I hadn't been declared in the bankrupt. But anyway, I thought I'd die there. I was 33 years old, and I was bored of anything good and decent in my life. And I thought I'd die there. I mean, there was no way out. I had nothing or nobody. I had long since, I told you earlier, I never had any feelings for God and religion and that stuff. Never entered my mind. If I ever prayed, I didn't know it. Somebody asked me one time, "Did you ever pray back there?" I said, "I don't know who I'd have prayed to." I didn't believe it, anyway. One of the speakers was talking about defiance. Defiance is my middle name. You know, the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous in our 12 and 12 talks about defiant people, and I was one of them. And I challenged God, and it might have been Stu last night talking about that. You know, if you're there, come here. You know, hell with you. I'm not afraid of you. I'm willing to face you. Look at me, and look what's going on in my life, you know. And so I just lived in utter despair. And I knew that I would die there, and I was a filthy-looking piece of human flesh with a long hair and a beard and suffering from malnutrition and dehydration, which causes you to swell, and most of my teeth had been knocked out, you know. And I was reading an article the other day for newcomers. It said there's three ways to take care of your teeth. See your dentist twice a year, brush after every meal, and mind your own damn business. And I wasn't very good at the last. So I only had about 9 teeth when I got that ass. So you can imagine what I look like. And I'm sitting in the back room of this saloon that morning with a bottle of wine, and the back door of that saloon opened, and in walked my father, which I hadn't seen my father in 2 or 3 years. Well, maybe not that long, but a long time. And hadn't talked to him in God knows how long. He wanted nothing to do with me, and I didn't blame him. But he had a guy with him I never saw before in my life. And the guy that was with him came over to a table where I was sitting, and stuck out his hand. Very well-dressed man. Distinguished-looking gentleman. Gray hair, suit, tie. He said, "Hi, my name is Jack. I understand so is yours." And I was dumbfounded that, because people didn't do that to me the way I looked. You know, and I was sort of in a daze over what was my father doing here, and who was this guy with him, and what the hell's going on here. And my dad goes over and sits on some stools that went around a lunch counter, and then this guy comes over to the table where I'm sitting, you know. And it was just an unbelievable thing going on, and, you know, and he, here he sticks out his hand and tells me his name, and he said, "I understand so is yours." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've come out here to help you. I hope you'll let me. I can't help you if you won't let me, but I hope you will, because I'd like to help you." And I asked him the obvious question, I think anybody would, why? Why would somebody that looked like he did come to where I was to talk to somebody that looked like me? It made no sense. Why? Why would you care about me? I had nothing. He said, "I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here. I used to be like you are, and somebody helped me, and that's why I'm here." It was unbelievable that he could have ever been like me, but he had been. He said, "Come on, go with us. I have made arrangements to have you admitted to a hospital." You know, and I, he said, I told it like this, the way I look. It's made a thing to change to. Great place to go. You know, I don't know what the hell I thought I was going to do. You know, and he said, "Yeah, we're going now. Come on." And he made arrangements to have me admitted to a psychiatric hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, called Our Lady of Peace. Now, this was 1962. There was no such thing as alcohol treatment centers. God, you've come a long way. The big book talks about asylums, and that's what they were back then for alcoholics. You went to an asylum. I mean, we've changed in many areas. You don't go to asylums anymore. You don't go to you go to treatment centers. You don't go to group therapy by yourself anymore. They actually have other people there. Yeah. And I'm not real sure you can even be a real alcoholic if you go to group therapy with other people. Real alcoholics go by themselves. Have you ever drove down the highway in a car saying, "I think I'll stop there"? And the other guy said, "You better not." "Well, I won't stay in there very long." "Yes, you will. You're going to get in trouble." "No, I won't. There's 8 conversations going on in that car. Ain't nobody but you." Yeah. And then they say, "We're going to have group therapy in them places. You go in and dance, ain't other people there." But they took me to a psychiatric asylum, not a treatment center. Back then we used to shack up. Now you get in meaningful relationships. You've come a long way. So I went in there, and that doctor, like any psychiatrist in 1962, he thought I suffered from a Valium deficiency. And he put me in there and got me well. And in a week's time, I was doing pretty good. And the fascinating thing had occurred in that psychiatric institution that on that very day, August 21st of 1962, Alcoholics Anonymous went in that hospital. First AA meeting ever held in that hospital was held that night. And after I was in there for a while, about a week, I got better physically. And as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me today, I had not changed, and therefore I was me. And I was not very good at being me. Neither are you. You're not very good at being you until you've changed. The way you are is why you're here. And that's the reason I was there, because of the way I was. So I was in there, not drunk, being me. Defiant. Arrogant, know it all, lying to some other drunk about why I was there, nervous breakdowns, those kinds of things. Nurse comes by, give me that Al-Anon handshake. "Don't you go anywhere tonight, we're going to the AA meeting." I said, "Going where?" She said, "To the AA meeting." I said, "What in the hell is an AA meeting? I never heard of AA. Never." She said, it's a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, Alcoholics Anonymous? Are you insinuating that you think I'm an alcoholic? She said, no, I'm not insinuating a damn thing. I said, I'll have you know that I'm no alcoholic. Alcoholics are people that have problems they can't handle. And we're not that way. I could handle these problems if it wasn't for. And everybody in this room has, if it wasn't for. But I said, I'm no damned alcoholic. And she said, if you're not one, there ain't any. I would have reported her if I'd have known who to. I said, I'm not going to your damned AA meeting. She said, you'll be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you over there where the doorknobs are on the outside. She said, we have rooms here where doorknobs are not on the outside, and you'll be in one of them. And I said, well, I believe we'll go. Kind of makes you feel like you're volunteering, right? I said, I'll go, but I ain't no damn alcoholic. She said, look at all the trouble. Yeah, I ain't no damn trouble. God, my nerves are shattered. She said, look what the hell you've done to you. I haven't done anything to me. They have. What is it for us to be wrong about? I couldn't think of a thing. Well, I was perfectly willing to be normal if they'd leave me alone. Never met an alcoholic that wasn't. Alcoholics aren't wrong about those things, especially the defiant ones. A guy told me a story one time about an old alcoholic cowboy out west. Come out of a saloon one day drunk, out in Texas. That's where John lives. Some old man come riding into town on mule. That alcoholic cowboy thought he'd have some fun out of that old man, and he walked out there in the street, and he asked that old man, he got off that mule, said, hey, old man, can you dance? The old man said, no, I don't know anything about dancing. That alcoholic cowboy said, I bet you can. Got that six-shooter out and started shooting at his feet. That old man got to dancing. Counting them bullets. When that alcoholic cowboy fired that sixth bullet, that old man reached up on the back of that mule and got a shotgun. He looked at that alcoholic and he said, have you ever kissed a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. Well, anyway, that nurse came and got me that night, and down there it went. Old lady stopped me trying to go in the door. Didn't want to go anywhere. I'd fallen in love with her in a week's time. Ain't long. I'm slow. By today's standards, alcoholics fall in love in them treatment centers 4 days. It's a quick, about every guy. That's interesting to see two drunks in love in a nut house. Put one sock on a foot and set them on the side of the bed. They don't want to lay down or get up. They're in love. Can't wait till they get out of there. A lot of times they don't. And some people that work in them places try to separate them. For God's sake, if you work in one of them nut house or treatment centers, you got two drunks in there in love, leave them alone. Do everything in your power to keep them together. I'm serious. Because if you get them separated, they'll screw up four people. Well, I went in that room and that old woman stopped me, smiled, 60-year-old woman. Called me honey. Big macho fourth and central drunk with a damned old woman's arm around me. She said, hi, honey. I said, honey, would you like a cup of coffee and a cookie? I thought, I wonder where in hell she thinks I'm from. I've heard them stories about old women and young boys. Well, I blew on past her and went there and sat down. Some fool got up to talk like I am now, sharing his story with me. I don't want to hear about him. What do I care about him? Came away to the great conclusion after making an ass out of myself. He talked and I talked. They tried to shut me up. I'm flying high on that Valium. It was an interesting meeting. He came away to the great conclusion after listening to him. Anybody drank like he did, ought to quit. I would have. But And yet, well, they're killers, aren't they? But, yet. So I made a fool out of myself, and I got ready to leave that meeting, and that old woman grabbed me, put her arm around my shoulder. She said, honey, come back next week. We need people like you. I thought they ought to put that old broad in a home somewhere. Get off of the street. So they sent me back the following week, and I sat down next to some old fool named Hillary Sanders. And he asked me how I was doing, a real old man. Crass, he sort of nasty. And he became my sponsor, naturally. He said, how you doing, boy? And I thought, that ain't none of his business how I'm doing. He don't work here. I saw him there last week. What the hell does he care how I'm doing? And that's the kind of attitude I had. But he was old. I said, well, you all be nice to old people. I said, I'm doing all right, old man, but I ain't no damn alcoholic. And he looked at me and he said, well, if you ever find out what you are, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell. So I got to move away from him. My psychiatrist told me I never grew up, never matured, never had an identity, never established who I was in life. And when you do that, you never develop emotionally. And when you don't develop emotionally, they label you as emotionally immature, and you behave in childlike manner. When you don't get your way, babies cry, right? We drink. You know, it's fascinating to look back and say, there I was, wet in the bed, crying for a bottle. But I was 35. You know, when that's what that baby's doing. And that's what they were talking about, emotionally immature. And he said, you've never understood who you were. In essence, you don't know who you are. And if you discover that with my help, electroshock therapy and Valium, we'll return you to social drink. And I thought, that's great. He said, aren't you a junior? And I said, yes, sir. Don't you work for the railroad? Yes, sir. I bet you on that railroad you were Johnny Sullivan's boy, never had a name of your own. I said, that's right. He said, most juniors have a lot of trouble in life. I said, I agree with that. Couldn't wait for my father to come up here and tell him if he'd named me Charlie, I wouldn't have gone through all this. Couldn't wait to get back and tell that old man, that old fool, run back there, the filing tube, and sat down next to him. He said, how you doing? I said, I'm doing fine, but I ain't no alcoholic. He said, really? I said, really? And nothing impresses a damned old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous when you say, my psychiatrist. God, that impresses them. Yeah. My psychiatrist said, I never had an identity. I don't really know who I am. He said, I believe that. Well, I'm no damned alcoholic. And I went through that big rigmarole. That old man looked at me and laughed. He said, well, I'm going to tell you something. If you'd have been a great pitcher in the Garden of Eden, you'd have been a drunk. I got up and moved away. I stayed there for another week, wound up 40 days in a mental institution in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, got out of there and came back to Louisville, and my sister let me live with her. And I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous out of fear. You know, I had a healthy fear that I'd go back to that alley. And I didn't want to go back to that alley. And I started going to the meetings and doing what the hell they told me and hanging around with that old man. You know? And I stayed there long enough to learn what it was I needed to learn. And I stayed there long enough to be able to listen and do what they told me to do. And I know out here they have strong sponsorship, and that is very important. And back then with those people, that's the way it was. They did not tolerate you doing anything. You had nothing to say. You've heard them say, they said, sit down, shut up, and listen. And that was it. You had nothing to say. Where I came from and the people that I dealt with, you were not allowed to go to a discussion meeting. Yet they had nothing to say. If you had any damn thing to discuss, you discussed it with your sponsor. And you went to speaker meetings and you listened to what the people had to say in order that you might identify with somebody from behind that podium. And it's one of the main ingredients in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time and in this day is identification of people. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, you cannot be drugged into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you will not be in my home group to listen to some guy that talks about snorting cocaine and smoking pot. By God, it don't belong in here. If you want to identify with people. I'm not saying you're not welcome. But what I am saying is that the identification of alcoholics comes from alcohol. And the identification of narcotics comes at Narcotics Anonymous. And I could identify with these speakers. And I listened to what they had to say. And truly, as I told that old man, you know, I am powerless over alcohol with an unmanageable life sober. Aren't we all? Came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Where was that power? It was the power within the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. The insanity of my life was not being able to see me for what I was. You hear in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about altering your perception. I think I saw a tape somewhere that Clancy made or somebody, the disease is a disease of perception. When you look at the definition of perception, you can certainly understand that because it simply means the truth as you see it. That's what perception is and nothing more. The perception of your life is the truth as you see it. Not as I see it, not as anybody else sees it, but as you see it. What kind of person are you, really? And until you can honestly look at that and see that, you don't stand a ghost of a chance of getting well because you can't change something you don't believe you've got. And I had to believe that my own dishonesty was the very thing that kept me insane. My insanity was related to my dishonesty. Fascinating thing about addiction. You will attain the same degree of sanity as you do honesty. That and nothing more. Even to this day. Even to this day, it's such a necessary thing in all of our lives. Would you like to believe that somebody that stands up here 27 and a half years sober and all these speakers this week with many, many years sober don't go through hellacious days? Don't you ever think that they hurt and ache and they don't know whether they can tolerate it anymore or not? And they got to talk to somebody, because it's the thing that we always did. And if you notice people in AA with a lot of sobriety, sometimes they get drunk, it's because they don't do it. There is nothing in this program that will make every day a great day. But those people believed back then there was something in this program that made every day better. And it made life an enjoyable way to live. I sometimes think maybe that's a lost art around here anymore because everybody's got to have some kind of a damn problem in order to talk about something. It seems like that we've got away from being human beings. Those people realized back then that Alcoholics Anonymous does not dehumanize anybody. Long before you were ever an alcoholic, you were born. You were a human being before you were anything. And you will always have the basic human emotions. You will always have the basic human problems. You will always have humanities that you wish sometimes were in existence, but they're there, and how you deal with them depends entirely upon whether you survive or not. And the only way you deal with them is you deal with them with the people that have helped you deal with everything. It's an absolute. It's a must. You will always have them. You cannot be dehumanized in this program. And I realize that today. And I realize it then. Do I have control over my own destiny? Absolutely. Not in regards to what happens to me. There are many things I have no control over that happen. But I have all the control in the world over how I react to what happens to me. And every one of you sitting in this room are the people that when I come to you and say, Hey, man. I just don't remember hurting like this in a long time. You know? If you got a little strength today, I don't care if you've been sober 3 months, 3 years. If you got a little strength today, I need the boy some. I'm going through a bad period of time in my life, whatever it may be. And the only thing that I'm responsible for is to depend on you. And when I lay down at night, I have to be able to say I did the best I could. I did the best I could. And I can't do any more than that. And that's what I learned from honesty and sanity. And I said to that old man, well, I want you to know one thing. I never have, and I never will, believe in a God. There is no such thing. And he looked at me and said, who cares what you believe in? I couldn't care less what you believe in. You see, what you believe in brought you here. And I want you to know that I believe in you, and God believes in you. And it's only important in your life today what we believe, to hell with what you believe. And I said, you mean that God doesn't care if I don't believe in him? He said he couldn't care less. That's a hell of a blow.
Hell of a blow.
You see, and it's really not important. Because God believes in you, and God knows, and I know, if you stay here long enough, if you don't drink, and you stay here, and you stay with good people, like I did, and like you do, then you will come to believe in a power that's greater than you. And you will come to understand and realize that God's will for you is nothing more than a complete change of your own, to where you learn to live and not die, where you learn to grow and not rot, where you learn to give and not take, where you learn to love and not hate. And you'll find in this program love, and I know love has many dimensions, but you'll find in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous a love that I don't think exists anywhere else, because it's the love that we have for each other. It allows boy to love boy, girl to love girl, because of its simple meaning. You know, because if I look at you and tell you I love you, I do not love you for what you are. I love you for what I am when I'm with you. I love you not for what you are, but for what I am when I'm with you. And after a certain protracted period of time in my life, a feeling came over me that I knew sobriety would be easy and life would be happy, because I found a way to be at peace with myself and with you and a God that I could understand. And I know it's all in feeling. A language of the heart, absolutely, but it's all feeling. It has nothing to do with knowledge. Nothing. And I can prove that by taking this room and putting it in total silence, and you feel the presence of each other and the presence of God in a force you never find anywhere else on this earth. And you know you're going to be okay. And I'm going to tell you that if you're new, if you won't drink, if you'll come here, if you'll listen to us, you'll be okay. I got my job back with that railroad, and I met a lovely lady after I sobered about 8 months, and we got married. She's with me here today. She goes everywhere with me. I don't travel without her. I've been married to her for 27 years. My sponsor got her in Al-Anon. There's nobody but her and I. She's been a good member of Al-Anon for 26 years, and I do not go places and leave her at home. It was pointed out to me very early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know whether you've ever noticed it or not, but you see slogans around these walls. Some of them came from where I don't know. But the three that are in the book, big book, it says, live and let live, easy does it, and first things first. The other ones are not in there. But I would like for you to become aware of the fact, if you aren't already, that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, those slogans are in the chapter of the family afterwards. And first things first, and easy does it, and live and let live, pertain to me and my family, and not just to me. Yeah. And nothing becomes more important in serenity and in happiness than my family. And my family is my wife. And where I go, she goes. And I don't intend to change that. I'm very happy to be here. I'll close by telling you a story that I always close my AA talks with. I remembered it well, and I hope you do too. It is, for some reason, a meaning to me, and it always has. It was about a man who was walking down a very cold and lonely road one night. In the middle of the road laid a snake. And when the man passed the snake spoke to him and said, Mister, please, please, pick me up and put me under your coat and get me warm that I may live. If I lay on this road in the cold of the night, surely I'll die. And the man said, I can't do that. You are a poisonous reptile. And surely if I got you warm and restored you to vitality under my coat, you'd bite me. And the snake said, I wouldn't bite you if you saved my life. And he thought about it for a while, but he picked him up and put him under his coat. And when the snake was restored to vitality, he bit him. And the man grabbed the snake and threw him out from under his coat and back to the road. And he looked at him and he said, I thought you promised not to bite if I would help you. And with a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked at him again and said, you knew what I was when you picked me up. My friend, if you're sitting somewhere in the confines of your own home, in a bar, wherever it may be, if you take the cap off of the bottle, the cork out of the jug, rationalize to those who care to listen, justify to those who want to hear. But if you've been here, if you know me, if you've met us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me and coming.